Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The White House said no deal on the Keystone XL pipeline today. What's that? Were politics involved? Oh, you betcha. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome to the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 18th of January. Good to have you with us. And if you wanted one issue, a single element that you could use to crystallize the economic debate this election year, well, I think we got it for you today, because this afternoon the White House rejected what's called the Keystone XL pipeline. Would have run from the Canadian oil sands down to the Gulf of Mexico, and it still might eventually. But instead, it's become a big tangle of jobs creation, American competitiveness, government regulation, and that's before you even get to the bit about energy policy. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
The administration's reason for no shouldn't have rushed us. In December, congressional Republicans gave the president a two-month deadline to decide yay or nay on the pipeline. Energy consultant David Goldwin says everyone knew that was unrealistic.
It was clearly a very cynical ploy to force the administration to reject the pipeline so they could use this as an electoral tool.
So now the right has two issues for the campaign, the energy issue and the jobs issue, turning down a shovel-ready project. The left has an environmental issue, and consumers have an energy bottleneck.
Only in America could conservative Republicans combine with environmental activists to increase global dependence on Middle East oil.
That's for now. Down the road, even environmental activist Bill McKibben figures more Canadian oil sands will find its way to market.
Environmentalists never win huge permanent victories.
As he sees it, his side basically bought some time for the world to wake up to global warming.
For the moment, we can slow down some of that mining of the dirtiest energy on Earth.
In fact, the industry is already finding pipeline workarounds, since we, the global consumer, are willing to pay for it. Trains and trucks are moving oil sands to refineries, even though it's pricier and less efficient that way. Analyst Mark Rout is with KBC Advanced Technologies.
This crude is literally moving everywhere, anywhere, by any means possible.
By the way, the Keystone Pipeline extension is not dead. The company can reapply if it wants to fight it out again after the election. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Speaking of oil, as we are, prices have been on the rise of late. It's due mostly to rumblings of a Western boycott of Iranian oil and the reciprocal threat from Tehran of a blockade of the Persian Gulf and the Straits of Hormuz. Today, though, Saudi Arabia, the world's biggest exporter of crude, promised to do what it takes to keep prices right about where they are, around $100 a barrel or so. We asked Marketplace's John Dimsdale to find out why.
The Saudis have reassured oil-importing countries that even if they go ahead with a boycott of Iranian crude, their demand for fuel will be met and prices will stay stable. Philip Verleger with the Peterson Institute for International Economics says it's simple self-interest.
Saudi Arabia is very much aware excessively high petroleum prices will accelerate movement away from oil. And they understand that a price spike that might be caused by some irrational Iranian action would hurt their long-run financial interests.
Affordable oil benefits the U.S. economy, too, encouraging growth while keeping inflation at bay. But is $100 a barrel affordable?
This is not a great gift to the world. That's a high oil price.
Steve Levine with the New America Foundation says the last time the Saudis pegged the price, it was $75 a barrel. He says the Saudi government needs more oil income ever since the Arab Spring.
The Saudi king has thrown a bunch of social spending at his people to tamp down any possibility of an uprising. The estimate is that the break-even point for Saudi Arabia for that spending is around $85 to $90 a barrel oil.
Levine says if Iranian tensions ease and Nigeria deals with its supply disruptions, oil prices could fall as much as $20 a barrel. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Well ahead of tax time for the rest of us, Mitt Romney is deep into the innards of his Form 1040s. The GOP presidential hopeful said yesterday, after months of hemming and hawing about it, that he figures he pays taxes at a rate of around 15%. That's a far lower rate than most middle-income families get. Romney's explanation? was that his money comes from a different source than most other Americans' finances do, investments. But riddle me this, why do some but not all investments get a special tax rate to begin with? Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon's been asking around.
It's been this way almost since the advent of the federal income tax a century ago. Capital gains, profits from selling an investment asset like stocks, have been taxed at a lower rate than income from your work.
Why would you want preferential treatment of certain kinds of income? The argument has to be because you think the preferential treatment is good for the economy overall.
Laura Tyson is a business professor at the University of California at Berkeley and a former economic advisor in the Clinton administration. She says proponents have long argued for special capital gains treatment.
On the grounds that lower tax rates will encourage more savings and more investment, and that those forms of behavior will have trickle-down benefits.
Tyson contends evidence of any economic benefits is weak and inconclusive. At Syracuse University, Professor Len Berman says the numbers are conclusive on one point.
If you look at the data, the overwhelming majority of capital gains reported on tax returns are reported by people with very, very high incomes.
People who pay just 15%, much lower than the top income tax rate of 35%. He points out the stock market investments that most Americans have don't get the same kind of treatment.
In the case of the 401k, you're ultimately taxed at ordinary income rates.
Berman favors the kind of tax reform Ronald Reagan pushed into law briefly back in the 1980s. It's the same idea recommended by President Obama's bipartisan budget advisory panel. Lower income tax rates overall, but then tax everything, including capital gains, at the same level. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, optimism is a word you might fairly use. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As if we really needed confirmation that everything in Washington this year is being done with one eye firmly on the November election. No sooner did word leak about the Keystone Pipeline decision this morning than House Speaker John Boehner said the president was hurting the economy. Of course, the decision by the White House itself was political, too, so that's the way it's going to be this year, tit for tat on the economy. Today we've asked two commentators, one a Republican, the other a Democrat, to explain how the economy is almost certainly going to hurt the other guy worse come Election Day. First up, alphabetically, from the GOP side, Todd Buchholz.
Long before Donald Trump's apprentice, Billy Crystal starred in the movie Mr. Saturday Night. Crystal plays a crotchety TV host who chews out his staff. You're fired! You're fired! One guy squeaks, I don't work here. Crystal says, you're hired! Now you're fired! Get out of here! Americans aren't shy about firing their president when the economy flounders. That should worry President Obama. Today, the jobless rate is 8.5% and drifting lower. But the American people threw out George Herbert Walker Bush in 1992 with a 7.4% jobless rate, and he'd won the Gulf War. Ronald Reagan got the American people to toss Jimmy Carter overboard. Reagan had a great punchline worthy of Billy Crystal. Recession is when your neighbor loses his job. Depression is when you lose yours. And recovery is when Jimmy Carter loses his. Reagan, like Obama, inherited a lousy economy. But Reagan won a landslide re-election with patriotic ads that rang true because Reagan himself appeared like a nostalgic Uncle Sam poster. People felt his tax cuts worked. The slogan, it's morning in America. What can Barack Obama say? It's 2012, but it's not the end of the world. Obama's got to do more than prove the Mayans wrong. He's got to show he's on the side of discouraged independence. That's tough when you come off as cool as a bebop riff. Obama told Rolling Stone he listens to a lot of Miles Davis. But Davis used to play with his back to the audience. A president is not a jazz virtuoso. Instead, he's our national talk show host. Johnny Carson, Brian Williams, Conan, Regis, Letterman, Leno rolled into one. And right now, when Americans see Barack Obama, they're ready to change the channel.
Todd Buchholz was an economic advisor to the first President Bush. He is most recently the author of Rush, Why You Need and Love the Rat Race. So that's one opinion. Here's another. From Jamal Simmons. He's the National Democratic Editor at GoVote.com.
By most measures, our economy stinks. The stock market does loop-de-loops every week. Americans have had their homes foreclosed upon. The unemployment rate is declining, but too many people still can't find jobs. Meanwhile, the wealth gap has grown even wider, and our debt grows larger. President Barack Obama is in real jeopardy of losing his job, but his renewed focus on the economy and his Republican opponents just might save him. For the first 2 years of his presidency, Mr. Obama was focused on passing big policy changes such as the financial stimulus, health care, and financial regulatory reform, but there was little economic messaging for Americans to hold on to. Since September, the president has been traveling the country relentlessly, pushing jobs and economic plans, and judging by recent polls, Americans are starting to like the focus. Meanwhile, the Republicans in Congress have been fighting to protect tax cuts for the wealthy, and the back and forth over the payroll tax cut smelled of politics, nothing more. And the Republican presidential primary process has degenerated into something akin to a circus. First, Donald Trump spent weeks on television, like a carnival barker, trumpeting the non-controversy over the president's birth certificate. Then, former Godfather's Pizza CEO Herman Cain joked and sang his way to first place with his 999 plan until he was deluged by controversy and dropped out. Meanwhile, Mitt Romney has been contorting himself into a pretzel by disavowing his previous policies to fit the desires of the GOP right wing, and Newt Gingrich isn't even organized enough to get his name on the ballot in his adopted home state of Virginia. The Republicans haven't projected the seriousness our current predicament requires, and whoever emerges from their process may find it hard to escape the taint of this circus. That may leave a weak choice for voters looking for an alternative to President Obama.
Jamal Simmons is the National Democratic Editor at GoVote.com. Take a second, tell us what you think about the election or whatever else you like. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. Raise your hand if you've ever printed out a document you could have just as easily read on your computer or your phone or your tablet. Yeah, my hand's up, and there's probably a little green guilt, right? But a study out today confirms what history shows. Pretty much everybody prefers to read on printed paper, not on a screen. Interesting part, though, is that the study is from a new paper advocacy group called Two Sides. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Troe explains.
That stink eye you get when you head to the printer, that's the mark of successful messaging, but not from who you might think, says Don Carley at the Institute for Sustainable Communication. He says the don't print, save a tree line comes largely from the billing and payments industry.
They found that, lo and behold, if you told consumers that by switching to electronic billing, you would be doing something good for the environment, there was a significantly increased likelihood that they would switch.
He says electronic billing saves companies a lot in postage and printing fees, but there's no proof it saves trees.
If a company tells you that by adopting or using their product, it will save a tree, habeas arboris, show me the tree.
Paper's image has been pulped by green claims about digital media. Now the industry's pushing back. The paper company Domtar, for one, has a campaign called Pixel to Print. Brand manager Louis Fix says a flowchart helps users decide, paper or screen.
It allows us to have an elevated conversation about this. You know, how are you going to use this information? Are you going to skim it? Are you going to read it and study it, edit and discuss?
And Carrie Cesario at the World Wildlife Fund agrees. Printing can be eco-friendly.
If it's coming from a well-managed forest, if it contains a high amount of recycled content.
She says if the electricity to power your technology comes from fossil fuels like coal, paper stacks up even better. I'm Eve Troe from Marketplace.
Coming up, the real trick to reinventing Detroit.
The high-skilled, high-paid talent that will work in those biotech and alternative energy companies. They want coffee shops, they want restaurants, they want dry cleaners, they want men's lifestyle magazines.
And they want the numbers, too. The rally on Wall Street rolled on. The Dow Industrials picked up 96 points today, 0.75%, closed at 12,578. NASDAQ up 41 points, about 1.5%, 2769. The S&P 500 jumped 1.1%, 14 points, ended at 13.08. Financials turned it around after yesterday's drubbing. Goldman Sachs shined up 6.75%. Quarterly profits fell, but the firm held down expenses. Morgan Stanley shot up 6.75% today. Tech stocks, though, really called the tune. Semiconductor stocks, to be precise. Linear Technology tipped up more than 11.5%. Texas Instruments climbed 8.5%. And on a different tech note, Yahoo continued its climb after co-founder Jerry Yang's resignation yesterday gained more than 3%. For the bell today. In Europe, markets were mixed. Britain's FTSE took home 0.1%. The French CAC 40 bid adieu to about the same amount. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note, 1.90%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Charleston, South Carolina, the contenders for the Republican nomination debate the issues. CNN airs the event. The U.S. Conference of Mayors continues its annual winter meeting in the nation's capital. A discussion on the 2012 presidential campaign and what the candidates are offering to support cities is on tomorrow's agenda. And the curtain goes up on the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Whatever winds up happening with those online piracy bills that are the reason so many websites have gone dark today, I can promise you this. As the congressional debate really gets going over SOPA and PIPA, as they've become known, we're going to be hearing a lot of numbers, dollar figures for how piracy hurts our economy, and counter numbers on why it really doesn't. Stephen Sywick is with the consulting firm Economists Incorporated, where he spends a lot of time looking at the costs of online piracy. Mr. Sywick, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you.
So help me, if it's possible at all, to come up with a number we might use when we're talking about piracy in this context.
Well, it's hard to come up with a specific value if you haven't studied the year in question, but certainly you may be approaching beyond $50
billion. $50 billion. How do you get there?
There are a variety of studies that really lay out what I think is becoming a fairly standardized methodology, which take account of survey results. So you can get data on this question.
Survey results. You go out and ask people whether they bought pirated stuff?
Yes. And in fact, surprising to many of us, they will tell you. For example, yes, I saw and downloaded 3 pirated movies in the last month. They will admit this.
And you take that and you extrapolate by the size of a hypothetical market and you get your $50 billion.
Well, right, because if you have this value where the person is downloading, the next question is, well, how many legitimate movies would you buy if you could not buy pirated movies, recognizing that legitimate movies have a positive price?
I imagine you have to make some assumptions here about the data set.
Yes, you do. It's a sort of counterfactual look at the world, but it can't be avoided.
So we're talking specifically here about intellectual property in these two bills that are going through Congress. But let's say I'm linking to an eBay site of a fake Louis Vuitton bag. I mean, do we roll all that valuation in there, too? Because that's not, well, it is intellectual property, but it's real property, too.
Most of the work that I've personally done has been in motion pictures, television programs, recorded music, which would exclude the Louis Vuitton bag.
Mm-hmm.
However, there have been others who have studied not only piracy, but counterfeiting, which extends well beyond handbags into things like cigarettes and prescription drugs, all those sorts of things.
So that $50 billion number that we said earlier in the interview, it could conceivably be, once you throw everything in there, it could be many multiples of that.
Well, it certainly would be way north of $50 billion.
Right. Are we ever going to get a number that we can agree on? I mean, as Congress sets about marking up these bills and they say it costs however much it does to the American economy, will there be a number that is universally accepted?
I don't know that there'll be a number that's universally accepted, but it is interesting to me how much fighting there is over these precise numbers when I think the more important question is the order of magnitude right? No one seems to quibble with the basic existence of piracy. No one says there is no piracy. And so it is a question just of measurement. And I think what will eventually happen is there'll be kind of a consensus range. There'll never be total agreement on one number. But in a range in which policy will be made, I think.
Stephen Sywick at the consulting firm Economists Incorporated in Washington, D.C. Mr. Sywick, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much.
You don't have to listen too long or too hard to the political discourse in this country before you hear the phrase job creation, whether it's helping existing businesses expand or encouraging would-be entrepreneurs to start new ones. But how do you do that in a city that's come to symbolize the worst of what the Great Recession brought? Marketplace's Gregory Warner has our story from Detroit.
When I met Leah Moss this summer in Detroit, she was just about to publish the second issue of her luxury men's lifestyle magazine called Jack Detroit. She explained it to me as
Esquire, zoomed in on the Metro Detroit area.
Leah Moss is 23. She'd never published a magazine before, much less a men's magazine. A men's magazine featuring a scantily clad beauty she calls the Jill of the Month. So for help with that, she turned to the men in her life, her boyfriend, her brother, and her dad.
I can call and say, hey, would you want to see a picture of something of this? Things that I never would have thought of. So for the next issue, one of our Jills is going to be shot in a men's dress shirt.
And little else. But this is not a story about how young Leah Moss discovered male fantasies. It's a story about how she got swept up into Detroit's fantasy about itself. A story about what happens when you start your career in a city desperate for its own new start. So rewind the clock to May of 2010. Leah Moss graduates Michigan State Honors College with a double major in English and Literature and every intention of getting out of Dodge, working at some national magazine somewhere. She even writes a senior thesis about how wonderfully the magazine industry is doing.
The viability of the print publication industry in an age of new media.
Does that mean, like, how do I get a job?
It should have.
But it did not. 2010 was a terrible year for magazines. She sent out 152 resumes. She got back
nothing. Nothing.
Her friends all gave her the same advice. Get out of this dying town.
Pretty much everybody that I knew from college is gone. And so everybody said, come stay with me.
But she didn't want to move to Chicago, bus tables, and crash on someone's couch. Instead, she decided to start her own magazine in Detroit to prove those deserters wrong. But how do you launch a glossy rag if you're 23 with no experience and no cash? You post a video on Kickstarter.com touting a product that doesn't exist yet.
Its bold, innovative presentation caters to young, professional males.
That video raised $10,000 from internet donations.
I'm in awe.
This is the appropriately named Francine Wonder. She works at Tech Town, a business incubator out of Wayne State University. And Tech Town began like every other incubator in the Midwest, trying to attract 21st century jobs to a 20th century city. But Tech Town ran into a problem, much like Leah Moss had faced. No one wanted to live in Detroit.
The high-skilled, high-paid talent that will work in those biotech and alternative energy companies, they want coffee shops, they want restaurants, they want dry cleaners, they want men's lifestyle magazines, and Detroit needs to create them.
TechTown literally had to build those urban comforts. So it helped a hair salon launch an organic product line, helped a pedicab company grow its fleet. It even started a coupon website like Groupon for Detroit. And TechTown helped Leah Moss write a business plan and secure a grant from the Hebrew Free Loan Association, which had its own motive to keep smart Jewish girls from leaving Southeast Michigan.
It's a vibrant Jewish community here, but all the young Jews are gone.
Suddenly, Leah Moss had nearly $50,000 to spend and what felt like an entire community rooting her on. She started publishing Jack Detroit and put free copies in shops and bars. Inside were profiles with local record labels and restaurateurs, a Red Wings goalie, a fashion designer who competed on Project Runway, and all these people trying to build a new Detroit. Moss sold advertisements, too, but not enough of them. By the end of November, right after the holiday issue,
I made the public announcement that the magazine would be closing at the end of the calendar year, and essentially it was a financially driven decision.
She was now thousands of dollars in debt and unemployed. No worse off, she jokes, than her friends that didn't go to state school. But still, she was faced with this irony that a magazine everyone told her would change the narrative about Detroit fell victim to that same bad news Detroit story.
And at first, I was like, exactly that, like, oh, of course, you know, I published something that now matches everything else that's been published about this city.
It's tempting to look back and say Leah Moss was a bit taken in by Detroit and its boosters. A city with nothing can still traffic in enthusiasm. But what happened next to Moss says even more about this city teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. The day after she folded the magazine, she got hundreds of emails, supporters reaching out, asking what was her next move, how could they keep her talent in Detroit. And 6 days later, Moss had a new job with Detroit Venture Partners, a VC firm even bigger than Tech Town trying to rebuild Detroit. Her new job? Well, she's a community catalyst, charged with mobilizing other young people to believe in Detroit's future, make a life here, and start a business. In Detroit, Michigan, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, I don't know if you caught it in Time magazine last week, but Warren Buffett said he would match dollar for dollar any contribution made by Republican members of Congress to pay down the national debt. And according to CNBC today, Buffett's going to write a check for $49,000 matching the contributions this year and last by Representative Scott Riegel of Virginia. Buffett further said he would match contributions by Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, 3-for-1. Nothing yet from McConnell's office on that one, though. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow picked up 96 points. That's about 0.75%. The NASDAQ added 41 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 gained 14 points on this Wednesday. That's 1.1%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. Coming up next time back here, you know, a lot of today's college students aren't kids. They work. Some of them have kids.
Between leaving work and getting out to the college, there was no dinner fixed. There was nothing done. My world was crazy.
But they're making college work for them online. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, that's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.